I was in tears. You know, so much was being taken away from me in my personal life. And all I could think of was, this is something they can't take away from me. This is going to be mine. This will always be mine. And it was just an incredibly emotional moment.
Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. This episode is a throwback to 2018, summer of 2018. David Morrow is hiking the Seven Summits, and Kurt is interviewing him. Travis was producing the shows at the time. Kurt was pretty much doing all the hosting. And a quick story about this episode, I was being trained to take over the show at this point. I didn't officially become host of the show until about fall of 2018, but I was already kind of involved in helping produce in the summer of 2018. And so this is one of the first episodes I was kind of helping out a lot with. And I remember, you know, just being so happy and so proud about it. The next day, I was somewhere for work, like a conference or something. And I remember just, you know, we were in line to get coffee at this conference. And I was talking to the guy in front of me. And we were just talking about what we do. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm starting to help out with this podcast. And he was like, oh, you know, what is it? And I said, Adventure Sports Podcast. And this episode had come out that day, that morning, with David Morrow. And he opens the app, you know, opens, you know, finds the podcast and looks at the episode, the first episode, and just this look of shock, of utter disbelief just washes over his face. And I'm like, you know, did I say something, or is there something that got leaked on the, like, what's happening? And so I was like, hey, man, like, what is it? And he just slowly said, my name is David Morrow. And I said, did we interview you for the podcast? And he's like, no, that's not me. He's like, I'm a different David Morrow. And it was just this weird coincidence where I was talking to a person with the exact same name, same spelling, same everything, to the person who had just had a podcast episode come out that morning. So it was a really interesting, bizarre situation. One of those things you walk away from and say, is that a coincidence, or was that, you know, put together somewhere? That's kind of wild. But anyway, that was a really cool just memory I had about this specific episode when it first came out 2 years ago, 3 years ago now. And anyway, I don't want to hold up too much of your time. As a recent podcast review recently said that, you know, Mason shares too many uninteresting stories and tangents. I don't want to hold up too much of your time. But anyway, here is the episode. And it's a long episode, but it's a really, really good one. Enjoy.
Hey friends, Kurt here. Today I have David Morrow with us, and David has climbed the Seven Summits. He has written a book about climbing the Seven Summits. He is an actor. He does live improv, living in Bellingham, Washington. I've already been visiting with him, and we've been having a ton of fun, so this is going to be a fantastic show. David, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Curtis. It's great to be here. I love the show. You know, when we got to the show booked, I went ahead and subscribed to the podcast and started listening to past episodes, and it's a great show. You folks do a terrific job.
Well, thank you. Thank you. There's a lot of back episodes to listen to. I don't know how many people have gone to look, but we're at about 400 episodes now. So there's so much back there in that back catalog, which of course people can get to on our website if they can't find it anywhere else. So adventuresportspodcast.com. But David, wow. You told me before we started that this book is not just about mountain climbing.
No, sir.
It is a book about growth and healing and discovery. It sounds like you pulled a lot of humanness into this part of your life in this book. Give us a little bit of the backstory, if you would.
Yeah, so I mean, the story starts at a very low place and ends at a very high place, to paint a broad brush. But the low place was I was 44 years old, and my marriage of 17 years was over. I was living in my sister's guest room and still grieving the death of my brother. I was completely out of ideas as far as what to do with myself and my life moving forward. And then a package arrived that changed everything about the trajectory of my life.
A package.
That's right, a package. It was a birthday gift. So the package was from my sister and her husband up in Anchorage, Alaska. And his name is Ty Hart. My sister's Noelle. And Ty was a well-accomplished mountaineer. And many months earlier, he had tried to talk me into joining an expedition to go up Mount McKinley, now officially named Denali. And when he issued the invitation, I said, look, I'm not a mountain climber, so this doesn't sound like a particularly good fit. That's a serious mountain. And, you know, but we're not getting along right now, my wife and I, and she wouldn't support it. So thanks, but no thanks. And he just said, you know, well, think about it. And it's a year away. And so I did think about it. And it was about 5 months after that that the marriage was over. And on my birthday, he sent me that package. And when I opened it up, it had a set of climbing poles and a note that said, "Happy birthday, super climber." In other words, your wife holding you back isn't exactly a problem anymore. So how about it? And, you know, the thing is this is, I did not believe that there was any reasonable basis for thinking I could make it to the top of Denali. I mean, it's a 20,000-foot mountain. But I also realized that I was in such a low place that failing couldn't bother me much, frankly. And, you know, it's a funny thing, Curtis, because a guy who thinks he literally has nothing left to lose is a pretty dangerous guy. I mean, probably good ways and bad ways, but in this case, good ways, because I wasn't afraid of failing. Not the least bit. And I decided I would do it in that moment. And I had 8 months to train, and train I did. I hired a personal trainer. I took it very seriously. I read everything I could. I did everything I could to be prepared. And I was in the best shape of my life when I left on that expedition. But I had no skills. I didn't know what I was doing. So most of the fitness I had was squandered pretty easily. And had it not been for the incredible team around me, there's no way I would have made it to the top of that mountain. But I did.
Mm. Well, we should unpack that a little bit, because a lot of people would like to try mountaineering, but they have no skills and they haven't trained for it. And so you just went through the process. You ended up climbing all seven summits, which we'll come back to that part of the story. When you headed to Denali, were you thinking only Denali at the time?
Right. Yeah. At no point did I say to myself, I'm going to climb the seven summits. It didn't happen that way for me. Each mountain I felt called me in its own way. And I was ready to be done mountain climbing at any point. And at one point in the book, I actually give it up. I'm done, and I'm satisfied. I'm at peace with that decision. And then something happens; it pulls me back in. I thought, look, this is going to be an experience, and it's a way to run away from my problems, and I had plenty of them at that point. And I also had this idea in my head, you know, I mean really, the only good thing in my life at that point that I could point to was Ty's belief in me, and because I didn't believe in myself anymore, frankly. And the idea hatched in my head that if I could make it to the top somehow, which I thought was unlikely, but if I could, I would come to believe in myself again. Mm. And that's probably the worst rationale possible for going to Denali. And to your listeners, I say, do not do that. But that's where I was at. And it was with those notions in my head that I left for Talkeetna in May of 2007.
Wow. Well, I kind of have to agree with you. You shouldn't necessarily climb a mountain to prove something. But at the same time, I don't know of any mountain I've climbed that didn't prove something. Do you know right. what I mean?
Yeah, I do. You know, the funny thing is in man's world, right, the day-to-day world, the reason why you're doing something is always there before you start it. But I think in nature and in personal growth, the why answers the last part of the experience. And a person's got to be willing to kind of trust the message life is sending them, that it will ring true in the end, because it almost always does. But that's not intuitive for most of us. We want to know why we're going to Denali before we're doing it, and what we're going to get out of it, and so on and so forth. And that isn't the way it works.
No, I would have to agree with that. It's in reflection of the experience itself.
Yeah, exactly.
The lessons that we may have thought we were going to learn, we don't always learn. But man, we learn things along the way we never anticipated. Do you have an example of that on Denali? Something that was a surprise.
Absolutely.
You go, holy cow, I didn't expect that.
Yeah. Well, so the main one that comes to mind is that we started off as a team of nine, and we eventually were whittled down to five. And before we left on the expedition, we were interviewed by local TV individually. And so no one saw the way the other guy answered the questions until we got back. And when we looked at the tapes, there was one question in particular they asked everybody, and that was, what's it going to take for you to get to the top in North America? And the four people that didn't make it all answered that question the same exact way. And the five people that did make it all answered it essentially the same different way. So here it is. The people that didn't make it all said, you gotta look at the summit. You got to keep your eyes on the prize. You know, you got to stay focused on your objective, that sort of thing. Those people didn't make it. Mm. The people who made it were the ones who said, you know, you just got to have fun hanging out with the guys, making camp, breaking camp, taking in the views, having a hot cup of cocoa. In other words, make each day its own mountain climb, and find joy in that day, which is so, so, so important. And so, you know, the strange irony about at least big mountains, and I've seen this again and again and again in my climbing, is that the guys who think about the summit almost never get there. It's just too hard. If you're only there for the summit, you're going to get crushed beneath your dream. It's just too hard. There's got to be something more to it. And there's got to be something each and every day, and that's joy. And so you need to live as though daily joy is your first responsibility. And it's a funny thing how you experience life when it shifts to that focus.
You know, that's an insight that I don't think a lot of people have come to. But man, that's one that applies to all of life. That's not just about getting up a mountain.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I like to say everybody's got their own Mount Everest, right? I mean, mine just happened to be Mount Everest. But you know, somebody listening to this is fighting cancer right now. That's their Mount Everest. Somebody else is trying to open that business they've dreamed about opening for, you know, all their work in life. That's their Mount Everest. Everybody's got their own Mount Everest. And the thing about those big, tough things that aren't just a sprint to the finish, it's going to take days, weeks, months, is you know what you're in it for, right? You know the summit is part of the deal, but that's got to be like a radio set to a low volume in the next room. If you just keep focused on that, you'll burn yourself out. And so, you know, you got to take that big mountain and break it down to smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. And you might say, yeah, I can't get to the summit of Everest. No, I can't get to Camp One. No, I can't get to base camp. But I can get to the village below base camp. That, yes, that I can do. And that is all you let yourself think about. Not one thing past that. There'll be plenty of time to worry about what's after that when you finish it. And it's that sort of simple baby steps approach to big, big things that makes all big mountains really just a lot of little mountains.
Mm. You know, Chris Warner, when we interviewed him about his climbing of K2, he said something that's kind of parallel, and I'm going to throw it out there just for comparison's sake, but he said that his team decided it really wasn't about getting to the summit. It had to be about how they climbed the mountain, the attitude mm-hmm. that they had, and the camaraderie, and the way that they attempted this feat was more important than the summit. And that's what got them to the top of K2. And I see a lot of parallels there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, because the thing is every time you think of the summit, it gives you kind of this little surge, right? A little adrenaline surge. It's like, oh, Yeah, that would be so great. But the thing about it is it's also kind of like taking an advance on a paycheck you haven't finished earning. And each time you think of it, you got to think of it a little bit longer to get that same high, right? Until the point comes when there's not enough money left in the check to justify the work it's going to take to earn the damn thing. And you're done at that point. You're just plain done. You're going to have a bad day. All climbers do. And the thought of the summit will come into your head and you'll be crushed beneath the weight of it.
Wow.
So when I climb big mountains, I won't even look at the summit. The whole trek into Everest, people would stop to take photos. I just kept my head down, kept trekking. I don't want that image in my head, because if I have a bad day and I see that image and I'm thinking, oh, it's another 10,000 feet above me, it'll just kill it right there. I gotta keep them small. Keep all those ideas small.
Man, there's so much that we could talk about today, but I just want to unpack that just a little bit too. You mentioned that you made the seven summits in seven attempts, and that's unheard of.
Yeah.
And it makes me think maybe it has something to do with what you're saying right now, that it was about the experience each moment, not about getting to the top.
Well, I would make the case that that was a big part of it, sure. So as you mentioned, most of these big mountains, these continental high points, take 3-4 attempts to get to the top, assuming a person ever does. So to get up to the top of one on a first try is pretty unheard of, but to go 7-for-7 is really, really unheard of. And I'm not saying no one else has ever done it. I think it's possible. I've just never heard of it. So I was extremely fortunate, and I do not discount the part that luck plays in it. I also worked extremely hard. I was with great climbers, really good people who are owed a great deal of credit along the way. But I also was keenly aware of the mental game, because I know most of the people that show up to, you know, an Aconcagua or one of these big mountains, physically they're capable unless they're just delusional. I mean, you're going to be in great shape when you show up. The mental game's where people lose this stuff, and managing it, managing your self-talk, your visualization, your relationships with your team members, how far you let your mind get out ahead of you. That's all so, so important.
Oh, it really is. I remember as my kids were just old enough to start doing some climbing and backpacking. And I kept telling them, I'd point at my head and I say, you climb this with your head. It's not with your feet. Mm-hmm. It's not with your legs. You know, you climb this with your head. And I would try to say, okay, I want you to say, I am strong. I want you to pat yourself on the back and say, look what I'm doing, you know? And those mm-hmm. sorts of thoughts give you the energy to keep going. But if you start thinking, I am so tired, then you're pretty much done.
Yeah. Sure enough, you will feel tired if you keep telling yourself you're tired.
I think you'll feel That's tired regardless, right?
Right. You know, but I mean, there were times when I was down to, okay, just 100 more steps. And then I was down to 10 more steps. That's all you got to worry about right now. Just 10 more steps. And if that's what it takes, you know, just smaller and small, whatever size increment you can say yes to, bring it down to that and then worry about what's after that, but not before.
Man, another great takeaway for life. You know, choose bites that you can swallow and then figure out the next bite when you're done, you know?
And that's the hard part, because we want to get out ahead of it. We want to say, yeah, I can do the 10 steps, but look at this head wall in front of me. What then? No. You're breaking the rules. You can't do that. You just worry about your 10 steps, and then we'll worry about the head wall after that. There'll be plenty of time to be consumed with fear and regret. That's okay.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, let's jump back to Denali here.
Let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsor, Aftershocks. If you've seen me at all in the last 2 years plus, I'm pretty much wearing these headphones 24/7. Unfortunately, some nights I actually am wearing them 24 hours because I fall asleep with them probably two nights a week. But they are these Aftershock headphones. And the reason is they're so stinking comfortable and convenient. I honestly forget they're on. And thankfully, they're waterproof. So, you know, I've walked into the shower probably 30 times in the last 2 years just wearing these and totally forget I'm wearing them until I wash my hair. It's crazy. I'm not even joking about this. But what they do is they rest on your ear and they rest in front of your ear, not actually in your ear canal. So what that allows is you can hear a podcast, you can talk on the phone, you can listen to music, but it's not blocking noise from your ear. So it's an incredibly safe feature, whether you're, you know, a cyclist or a runner out on your kayak, you know, watching your kids or needing to listen on a job site or at work. You don't have to actually turn the music off or turn the podcast off or take something out of your ear. I've honestly, it's been a game changer for me. I just got another pair, my second pair ever. I totally wore out my first pair, just literally wearing them every single day for 2.5 years. If you'd like to try a pair, they're giving all Adventure Sports Podcast listeners 15% off. Just go to this, go to our show notes. There's a link. Click on that. They give you a unique discount code. Then you can use that at their website. But yeah, if you want to learn more, just go to the show notes. Aftershocks headphones. I've honestly can't, you know, express enough how much I've enjoyed mine. So I'm going to be buying them for, you know, foreseeable future. That's for sure. All right, back to the episode.
You decided you're actually going to go for it. You trained really hard, and you had a group of, you said nine, is that right, people?
We started as nine, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then four didn't make it and five did, and you think it has a lot mm-hmm. to do with the reason that they were attempting the climb in the first place, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, I think it had a whole lot to do with it, yeah.
Okay, so just unpack Denali without huge details. What was it like to get up that mountain? A lot of people say it may be a more dangerous mountain than Everest.
Well, I don't know if it's more dangerous, but it was much harder to climb. Mm. Well, maybe not much harder, but it was hard. It was the hardest of the seven for me. And it has a lot to do with the fact that there are no porters or Sherpas. You're hauling all your own junk, right? You're pulling a sled with 90 pounds of gear while you're carrying a pack with 65. I weighed 190 at the time. So that's a pretty good ratio of weight to weight. And you're going uphill while you're doing all that. It can be very cold in the warm part of the year when climbers hit it, which is May, June. You'll see 30 below at high camp.
Wow.
It's almost in the Arctic Circle. And it's close enough to the Bering Sea to get some of those huge storms that come in off the sea and just hammer it. At one point, we were taking shifts, two-hour shifts, digging the tents out because the snow was falling so hard. And we did that round the clock for 3 days. There was literally never an end to shoveling. There was always someone out shoveling, or we would have just been buried. But wow. So it's a tough mountain and deserves every ounce of respect. And again, so much credit goes to my team members.
Well, it sounds like it would take a team, you know, especially when you have one of those scenarios where you have to shovel around the clock. Man, I mean, you can't do that alone, right?
Yeah, as a two-man team, forget about it. You just can't. It's too exhausting. So, having a team and having a good team who also have their mental game together and hopefully have real solid skills to make up for your lack of them. In my case, that's all pretty important.
So just out of curiosity, did you do acclimation climbs where you would go high and come back and sleep low and do that sort of thing on Denali, or were you able to acclimate as you inched your way up the mountain?
Oh, no, we absolutely carried high, slept low. Yeah.
Okay. And that seems like that's key for all of these expedition style climbs.
It is, yeah. Well, I mean, you're giving your body a fair chance to acclimate to altitude. And, you know, it's tough enough as it is. So be fair about this thing. Give your body a chance, you know. Ascend at a reasonable rate. Carry high. Sleep low. I never took Diamox until I was on Everest. I just found that I was fortunate genetically in terms of my ability to acclimate to thin air. And we were always very careful and measured about how we ascended. So that worked out.
Well, Denali is just such a beast of a mountain. It's so huge. I was blessed enough to get to see it once, but I've never been on it. And every time I hear someone tell the story, it's amazing to me. What an amazing peak that is. And then there's still other summits that are, you know, higher and maybe even badder. And so, when you summited Denali, what did that feel like?
Oh, I was in tears. You know, so much was being taken away from me in my personal life. And all I could think of was, this is something they can't take away from me. This is going to be mine. This will always be mine. And it was just an incredibly emotional moment. And anybody who goes to my website, davidjmorrow.com, there's actually film of that moment where my brother-in-law turned his camera on, put it in my face and said, well, how does it feel? And what you see is an image of a guy with not enough oxygen to cobble together a full sentence. But I eventually get something out to the effect of, you know, I probably look as bad as I've ever looked, and I probably feel as good as I've ever felt.
Wow.
Something like that.
Oh, that's so fantastic.
All of that said, we came down, went home. I was on a high for a while. And then this sinking feeling started coming back to me, the same one I'd had in my sister's guest room when I was living with her. And that was, somehow I still didn't believe in myself. And that for me was one of the big takeaways from Denali, is understanding you don't come to believe in yourself by climbing mountains, right? You believe in yourself when you deal with your problems. And I understood that now. And I understood my problems, and I was ready to deal with them. And so, you know, the book takes it from there, talking about what those are and how the mountains taught me to deal with them.
You know, you've mentioned the book a couple of times. I think it'd be fantastic if we could hear a little excerpt from it that you'd like to share, just to give us a flavor of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So hang on a second here. Something from Denali. Let me just, I've got a little excerpt I like to read. So this is an excerpt that takes place as we reach high camp, and we're trying to decide if we're going to skip the rest day and move on. And I'm clearly the weak link in the chain, and so it all kind of depends on me. So we retreated to our tents early that evening as the sun dipped, then disappeared around the west flank of Denali. The temperature quickly dropped to minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So our team meeting, shouted back and forth through thin tent walls, was conducted with each member burrowed deep inside his down sleeping bag. "So here's the thing," Harris began. "The weather forecast still says tomorrow's a good day, but there hasn't been any update for the day after. It could be good, or it could be the start of bad stuff. How are you feeling, D?" That was the nickname they gave me. "Whooped," I shouted back. "Yeah, I know it was a rough day, but you did good. Do you think there's any chance you'd be up for a summit push tomorrow?" The thought of resting the entire next day had been a big part of what kept me going. "Don't we need to go fetch our cash tomorrow?" I asked, hoping to deflect attention from myself. "Not for a summit push," Harris answered. "Most of that cash is extra food, batteries, and fuel. We can always get it the next day. If we summit, then weather holds us here." I thought about it for a moment. "I don't know," I said. "From here up, we don't pack any weight," Harris offered. "Just your lunch and heavy down gear." No one else spoke. It was just Harris shouting to me from the tent he shared with Sam and Mark, with me shouting back from the tent I shared with Ty. "I guess I'll have to see how I feel in the morning," I answered. "Okay, sounds good, Dee. We'll check back then," Harris ended. We were silent for several moments while each team member mulled the possibilities. Then I rolled over to face Ty and asked, "Do you think I can do it?" Ty could have said yes, and I would have believed him. He could have said no, and I likewise would have accepted his judgment. But Ty said neither. I now see that as a gift. Any summit push entails great effort and great risk. A climber may own success, or he may own failure, but the least he is owed is full ownership.
I like it. And so the next day, did you do the summit?
We did. We woke the next morning, and I felt rested. I felt ready. And when they asked me, I said, yeah, let's go for it. And there was a lot of whooping and hollering, and we got up and we did it.
Right on. Right on. So in my experience, when you do a big feat, when you're climbing a mountain, for instance, maybe it's running a marathon or whatever it may be, but when you accomplish a big feat, that doesn't fix everyday life. And you've alluded to that already.
Yeah.
But what happens, I think, is that you learn skills that help you to cope with everyday life. So did you take some lessons learned from Denali that started to help?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the lesson about, breaking things down to breaking a mountain down to smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. You know, the things I was dealing with in my personal life were mountains. Any time I thought about dealing with them, they were just too big. But now I knew how to take them and break them and turn them into little pieces that I could say yes to.
Mm. Let me throw some one-liners at you. I'd like your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
What if someone came up to you and says, I want to be the man that's climbed that mountain? What would your response be?
Yeah, I would ask him why. Why? Why do you want to be the guy that climbs that mountain? Why that mountain? Why you? Why now? Why? You know, tell me about your motivations. What it would mean to you if you succeeded? How, you know, you think you'd handle it if you didn't succeed? I'd want to have a conversation.
Mm. So how does that look if such a guy says, I'm going to be the man who climbed that mountain, and then you ask him? I mean, we're kind of getting hypothetical here, but you ask him, okay, what happens if you don't make it to the top? Then who are you? You think that's pertinent to this discussion? Is that what we're kind of talking about?
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, because I think people have funny ideas about mountains. I think that they can make the same mistake they make with their careers, you know, which is defining themselves by what they do. When you stop doing it, who are you, right? If you define yourself by the success you have on a mountain, who are you if you don't enjoy that success? So, you know, you want to get around the other side of that discussion and see what mechanics are driving it. Maybe there's a person that should climb that mountain. Maybe there's so much for them to learn in the experience either way that they really should pursue that experience. And it becomes a discussion then of, what skills, what conditioning do you have? You know, here are some things you can do to improve on those. You don't want to suffer your way to the top of any mountain. And the more prepared you are, the more enjoyment you're capable of having and doing it. And my God, this should be an enjoyable experience. Even though it is incredibly hard.
Mm. I kind of can predict the answer to this next question, but you are the man that has climbed those seven mountains, the seven summits on the seven continents. And it's an amazing feat for anyone to accomplish. It's just amazing. So you are the man that has climbed that mountain. How do you identify with that now? What would you tell people about that?
For starters, I am not a linear person any longer, and I most certainly was before that. So I work now, as I've worked for the last 30 years, as an investment advisor and certified financial planner. That's how I make a living. And that's, if you think about it, that's sort of the definition of linear. You know, you want to retire at this age. I had always heard motivational speakers in the industry sort of promote this gospel of linear thinking, you know, make a goal and never take your eye off it, and damned anything it gets between you and it. And it wasn't until I got involved in this adventure that I learned that advice is exactly wrong. And so now I'm much more willing to clear my mind and listen to life's instructions and trust them and act upon them without requiring that it makes sense now or I have all the answers now. And that is a big, big shift that came about through the course of this 7-year period in my life.
Yeah, it's worth thinking about that a little bit, isn't it? I think that's kind of fascinating that you realize that it's not linear anymore. So how does that play out in everyday life? Applicable ways that people could apply to their own experiences?
Yeah, you know what? What I would encourage people to do is make sure you set aside at least 10 minutes each day to be peaceful, to go into the silence. Now, I picked up meditation, so that's my form. Somebody else might do it with prayer. I mean, whatever you like, that's fine. But it's important to do that because so much noise and lights and urgency comes at us from every angle in life these days. And if you don't go into the silence, there's really no chance you're ever going to hear life speaking to you. You're just going to hear Wolf Blitzer speaking to you. Because the thing about it is when life speaks, it speaks very quietly. It will not compete for your attention. It will not shout. And so you need to find a place in silence. And I also believe that your dream world tries to communicate important instructions to you. And so I pay attention to my dreams, and I feel like I learn important things from them. But in any case, we live in a world now where it's not something that can be left to its own device, that at some point in the day you'll find yourself somewhere quiet and you can kind of clear your thoughts. It's got to be a deliberate thing now. And that's kind of too bad, but, you know, that's all right. You set aside that piece of time. For me, I get up an hour early each day so I can read. I'm always reading about something that I find interesting. When I'm done with that, then I'll meditate for 10 or 15 minutes, and it puts me in a nice, centered, peaceful place before I go into my day.
That's cool. I feel that, and it really is just a feeling, but I feel that if people take the time to listen to that quiet voice that you're talking about, they mm-hmm. might have more life experiences that are more fulfilling, perhaps. You know, that you say, no, I'm on target here. This is in sync with what my purpose is.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is when you're on your path, it's not always fun, okay? Because you're comfortable and life is happy doesn't necessarily mean you're on your path. And because the opposite is happening doesn't mean you're off your path. So think of it this way. A lot of people have a bucket list, right? The list of everything you can do before you kick the bucket. All right. But I believe if that's true, then the balance of life requires that you have a chuck it list, all the things you're never going to do before you die. Right. And some of those things you put there deliberately. Maybe you said, I'm never going to bungee jump. Okay, fair enough. And some things probably got there just of their own accord, right? I mean, it's too late for me to think about becoming a physician. Okay, fair enough. That's on my chuck it list. And I'm pretty sure climbing Denali and these other mountains were on the chuck it list. So, but the thing is this, is when you think about how you are going to spend your energy, you're going to the bucket list. It's you choosing your thoughts, your design. But every once in a while, something from the chuck it list will choose you. That is life speaking. And more than ever, it is so important to listen. And that's what I'm talking about.
Nice. Well, how did you get from having climbed Denali, returning to real life and realizing, well, that was a great experience, but it didn't fix me. How did you get from that to deciding to do the Seven Summits?
Yeah, I never decided to do the Seven Summits. I came back from Denali and retired from climbing forever, for a while.
Forever, for a while.
Yeah, you know, I mean, truly, I came back and I thought, okay, well, I'm glad I made it to the top. I feel like I really gained something in value and confidence and a better understanding of my path forward with my personal life. But that was really hard, and I just don't see myself doing any more of that. And so I was done, or I thought I was done. And about 4 months went by, and in that time, I'd gone on to online dating, and I'd met a fabulous woman to whom I'm now engaged. We just had this incredibly electric experience and hit it off so well right away. At about month two, she told me she loved me. And it was the thing I most wanted to hear, and it was the thing I was most afraid of hearing, because I was still so engaged in protecting myself. You know, after a divorce, people, I think, are kind of like that.
yeah.
And so I couldn't return the sentiment to her. And she said that was okay. She just wanted me to know how she felt, and she could be patient. And I knew I loved her. I just couldn't tell her. And that night I had this dream where I'm following this male lion through the tall grass in Africa, and we're walking towards Kilimanjaro, and dream ends. Except that I had that same dream night after night after night after night after night.
Oh, fascinating.
Until I was just obsessing with it, since I think, you know, my dream world tries to talk to me. I just kept thinking, what is my dream world trying to tell me? And finally, I just went to Lynn, this woman I was in a relationship with, and I said, look, I'm having this dream every night. I don't know what it means, but I think I'm supposed to go to Africa, and I think I'm supposed to climb Kilimanjaro. Now, tell me that doesn't sound zany, right? And the typical response to that would be, you're crazy. Why? You know, that sort of stuff. But she doesn't bat an eye. She says, I think you should go then. So I did. And I went and I climbed the mountain. Fabulous experience. And then afterwards, I'm on safari, because you're not going to go to Africa and not go on safari. And we're way out on the Serengeti, and there's this oasis type pond with lush trees around it. And there's this whole pride of lions just laying around with bulging bellies, right? They'd eaten for the day. And we stop in our Land Rover, and we're just watching them. And all these other animals are walking around. They're not at all afraid of the lions. I guess they know the lions have eaten. At any rate, so the driver, Hafif, he's telling me, you know, this animal here could do this to a person. That plant there has a juice that'll blind a man, and so on and so forth. And I was just struck. I said, this is the most beautiful and most dangerous place I've ever looked at. And the poetry of that rang true to me. I said, you know what? That's it. That's nature. Risk and return are always hand in hand, right? In the man-made world, not so. We're man-made world is structured so we can take without giving. We can experience beauty without personal risk, right? We've got sidewalks and laws and rules and this and that. Not so in nature. Personal risk and return are always hand in hand. And then it hit me. That was the problem with my protecting myself, is that in trying to take no personal risk, I could never fully experience the love that was being offered to me. I was going to have to risk myself to make this thing work. And that was when I realized what the dream was about. And I just looked at that big male lion lying in the grass, and I said, thank you.
Mm. That's beautiful, man. And I was going to say at the beginning, maybe Kilimanjaro, the mountain, wasn't your Kilimanjaro. Maybe your Kilimanjaro was learning to love again.
Yeah, there's a great deal of truth in that. There's this cool movie I saw years ago called Searching for the Wrong-Eyed Jesus. There's this great line in it where they say, sometimes you got to look away from a problem to see the answer. And I think that's what a lot of my mountain experiences were, is they were getting me to look away from the basic fact that I feared intimacy in this case, so that my heart and my mind would open up long enough for the truth of the situation to creep in.
Nice. Well, that's two great mountain stories in a row, but there are five more. What was next?
Next, I went to Elbrus, which is the high summit for Europe. It's in Russia. And I climbed that with the outstanding organization Adventure Consultants, who, by the way, had led my climb on Kilimanjaro as well, and had a marvelous experience there. Before I left, thing I was struggling with was, you know, now I was doing my mountain climbing, and to celebrate my each of my continental summits, I got the profile of Kilimanjaro and Denali tattooed to my right shin. It was just sort of my way of celebrating. But, you know, and the funny thing is you would think the people around you, you know, want to cheer on and celebrate your accomplishments, but that's not necessarily how the deal goes down. And I was getting pushback, largely from, you know, dudes, my friends, where You know, they were like, oh, that's pretty subtle, or yeah, but have you climbed Everest? And I was getting lots of comments like that. And I came to realize that the real problem was that I think I was threatening their comfort, right?
Oh yeah.
You get to be in your mid-40s, and you know, you've probably lived a good and useful life, you're raising kids. It should be okay to sit back and relax now. But for a man to do that, he's got to accept the fact that his days of daring do are behind him. And I was disrupting that belief, and they didn't appreciate it. And so I kind of went into hiding with with what I was doing in climbing. I didn't talk about it. I kept it from people because I didn't understand the pushback I was getting. And on the Elbrus climb, I met this Hindu woman, a young Hindu woman who was cutting against the grain of her family's very traditional belief systems about what a woman should and should not be doing, and she should not be climbing mountains. And she was doing it anyway. And I was so inspired by the strength and the confidence she showed. At the same time, my eldest son came out as openly gay in high school. And just the courage he showed in doing that. And so I took those two examples as important lessons about living a genuine life, and kind of found the courage to go back to living a genuine life myself. Yeah, Aconcagua was after Elbrus. So high summit for South America down in Argentina, 22,800 feet. A big, moody, windy son of a gun. I teamed up with my brother-in-law again on that one. He, as you'll recall, climbed with me on Denali. And him and I decided we wanted to do it the old school way. It's just two guys on their own. And we wanted to go up one side of the mountain and down the other. So that meant everything had to go over the top, which made for some massive loads. And we went and we did it.
Now, Ty, he got you on Denali, and it sounds like you guys enjoyed Aconcagua together. Was he trying to do the seven summits, or what were his goals?
No, he's really not into the seven summits at all. He just loved climbing mountains, and he's great at it. He uses what's called a power strategy of climbing, which tends to be slow, steady, plodding along. He's, in my opinion, one of the premier power climbers in the world today. He's just a tractor. You cannot stop the guy. But he loved climbing. So, you know, he talked me into Denali, certainly. And then, we kind of jointly talked each other into Aconcagua. And then, when it came time for Everest, I talked him into that.
Nice. So he did three of the mountains with you then?
Yeah, he did, which was just so nice, because he's just such an outstanding human being, and he's great company, and to have those shared experiences is just incredibly valuable.
Well, we could talk for another 2 hours about all of this, but let's skip to Oceania, because I want you to talk about, help me out here, Karstens. Did I say that right? Karstens Pyramid?
Yeah, Karstens Pyramid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, the thing is since we're talking about climbing continental high points, it bears noting that Australia isn't anywhere in the conversation, and that, of course, is a continent. So it'd be fair to ask, well, why are you climbing Karstens Pyramid in New Guinea instead of Kosciuszko in Australia? And the answer is that Kosciuszko, the high point for Australia, is only 7,000 feet. You can actually drive to the top of it. And so it sort of lacks the personal challenge that's typified by all the other continental summits. And that being the case, Reinhold Messner took it upon himself to come up with a better solution. And he said, look, let's include all of Oceania, which includes New Zealand and Australia, but also Papua New Guinea, with Karstens Pyramid at 16,000 plus feet, a much more formidable objective. And so, you know, some climbers will make their seventh summit Kosciuszko, and you know, with very little argument, they've climbed the seven summits, and good for them. It was still a monumental feat. But for others, they feel like, no, I want to do all this the hard way. So I'm going to go with a much more challenging Carstens pyramid to cap out my seven. And that was the choice I made.
Mm. Okay. And what is that mountain like? 16,000 feet. What are the parameters, talking about weather and that sort of thing?
So it's more like a long jungle trek with a 3,000-foot rock face at the end. And so, you know, the rock face, that part of the climb was a kick in the pants. I mean, that's what we're good at. We loved it, every minute of it. But getting to the rock face was the hard part because it's 6 days of jungle trekking. And for anyone who's never done jungle trekking, it's hard. We average less than a mile an hour. Everything is muddy and slippery, and you're falling down constantly. Sometimes the mud is hip deep. You're crossing rivers full of leeches, malaria. Am I selling this well? The topography looks like plates in a drying rack, where we would ascend 4,000 feet and then descend 3,000, cross a river, then ascend 4,000 feet and descend 3,000 for a frustratingly small amount of net gain. But the really fascinating part of it is just that, you're crossing three different tribal lands for indigenous peoples. And they have a storied history of not getting along. And so you have to sort of cobble this tentative peace together among them, because you're required to gaining access to a tribal land, you have to hire 15 porters, whether you need them or not. Needing them is not important yet, but you got to hire them. So three tribal lands, that's 45 porters. We start off as a team of 12, but we got winnowed down to six in about 3 days. So now you got 45 porters for six climbers, but it doesn't end there, because none of these porters are going to leave their families behind. These villages raid each other regularly. So one porter is going to bring his wives, plural, with him, all of his kids. And if his parents are mobile, he's going to bring those too. We ended up looking like an invasion force. We were like 300 some odd people for the sake of six climbers. And we didn't have to feed all those people. They just foraged on the trail each day. They would stop and dig up a big wild yam or some wild sugar cane, or they'd take a bunch of bark off a cinnamon tree. They'd kill a snake, whatever. But they fed themselves quite fine. And we had all our freeze-dried provisions, and sometimes we ate some of their stuff, which was cool. But it was just such a rich and colorful experience, but really, really hard jungle trekking. I mean, it was in the 90s in the jungle every day, and the humidity was heavy enough you could see your breath even at 95 degrees. It was just ungodly.
Wow.
That is the heat and the humidity. I know there are a lot of other challenges, but in my tiny little myopic world, the heat and the humidity would just kill me.
It sucks the life out of you. It really does. And I would, I had a little 8-ounce Nalgene water bottle that would fit in my pocket. And so whenever we stopped, I would drink, and then I would refill that thing so that I could drink while we're on the move, because we didn't do much stopping. And then I kept a bandana in the other pocket so I could wipe the sweat off my face. And I had a baseball cap, and every time we went through a river, I'd dip it and throw that over my head. And so you get these little moments of relief along the way. Among the six that spirited on, one member was a 65-year-old woman named Carol Master from Salt Lake City, Utah. She's a retired PhD. And this was her seventh of the seven summits. And she, like all of us, was falling down a lot each day. But when you're 65, it's different than when you're 35. And I watched her just beat the tar out of herself, never complain. She might lay there a bit, but then she'd get up and keep moving. And then she got sick, and she couldn't keep down food or water, couldn't carry her pack. And if we stopped to rest for 10 minutes, she'd just lay down in the mud and sleep. But she always got back up and kept going. And, you know, her quest became our quest. We all had so much respect for this woman. And any one of us would have given up our own summit attempt to make sure she got there. In the end, She got up the rock face, got to the Tyrolean Traverse, which this climb is well known for. It's a 80-foot gap in the ridge at 16,000 feet where you've got to hang from a wire and pull yourself hand over hand across. Yeah, and I don't know where she found the strength to do it. I honestly do not. But when we got a few steps from the summit, we all stopped so she could summit first. And I turned on my helmet cam and filmed that moment. And everyone was in tears. It was an incredible, powerful moment. And she made it. And she's now the oldest woman in history to do the seven.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So of the seven summits, which one do you think was the most impacting to you personally?
Wow. Well, that's a great question. I guess I'd have to say Denali, because it changed the whole terms of engagement between me and life and how I approached it. That made all the other lessons possible. So I would have to say Denali.
Okay. And the last summit now, are we talking about Everest?
Everest, yeah. Yeah, in 2013. To get to Everest was the decision that I would go, and that seemed like a long ways off because I had said that was the one I would never do. And I even reread Into Thin Air just to scare the hell out of myself and make sure I wouldn't change my mind later. So I was not going to Everest, and this was understood. We're still on Karstens. We summit, and now we're rappelling down that rock face. Now it's 19 separate rappels to get down a 3,000-foot rock face, so it's a lot of rappelling. And even though you're in a fairly jungle-like place, when you're at 16,000 feet, it gets cold. And so I'm halfway down the rock face, and I stop to kind of warm my hands up because they're getting numb, and I'm feeling chilled, and it's starting to rain on us. And I'm kind of rubbing my hands together, and I close my eyes for a minute, and the image of Everest pops into my mind, and I hear a voice say, "It will be all right." That's it. And I knew in that moment I was going to Everest, even though 5 minutes before that I was never going to Everest. But it was the clearest instance of life speaking to me that I've ever had. And I felt this warmth pass through me. I knew I was going to Everest at that point. Now, depending on your belief system, some people might say that voice and that message was coming from one place versus another. I'll let readers decide for themselves. And believe me, I'm not happy to admit that I hear voices, because people who hear voices end up featured in unflattering headlines, right? So I would be remiss to not tell it the way it happened, and that's how it happened. And so I met up with Lynn in Bali after that climb, and she was saying, "Gee, you know, you must have some thought about Everest." And I said, "Yeah, I want to climb it this March." And I was surprised how confident I sounded. And she said, "Well, you better get training then." And that set everything in motion towards Everest.
Nice. And we did skip a mountain there.
We did. We skipped Vincent Massif in Antarctica, which is a really cold place, by the way.
Right.
I flash froze all my fingertips there. What happens when you do that is when you come back down to normal altitude and normal life, they all turn white and the skin dies and they peel off and you're left with that translucent skin of last resort that's super creepy looking. But you can recover from that. But Antarctica was, the vastness of it is breathtaking, and the beauty is just never waning. It was a marvelous experience. That's covered in detail in the book as well.
All right. We have to get to the seventh summit on Everest and what it felt like when you finally stepped foot on it. So I can't imagine what that was like, but describe that for us if you can.
Here's how I would describe it. It's kind of like being paid in a currency that's unfamiliar to you. You'll only know the value of it when it's fully spent. And In the moment when I stepped up onto the summit of Everest, my first thought was, I'm all out of mountain. And I mean, I meant that literally and figuratively at the same time. I was just completely out of mountain. And I could sense the impact of what that meant, but I couldn't really understand the measure of it. I was just too exhausted. And I felt that perspective would come with time, and it has, and that's also covered in the book. But truly, you know, I stood there, and my Sherpa and I, we were alone on the summit. We were the first climbers to reach the summit that night. We were alone up there for 45 minutes and saw the sun come up. And I just stood on the summit, and one thing seemed really clear to me, and I just heard myself say, thank you.
Let's fast forward to today then. You summited in 2013, right?
Yep.
And so here we are 5 years later. What are you up to? Did you continue to climb, or have you moved on to other mountains?
No, I continue to climb. I'm not doing altitude climbing anymore. That was a pledge I made to my family. You know, they were so supportive of me, but I kind of put them through hell during this period of time. So I still climb, but I don't do the high altitude stuff. I'm high pointing right now. So, you know, just climbing the highest thing in each state. And I've knocked off Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Arizona, New Mexico. I'm saving Florida for last, in case I'm in a walker or something, but you know, that's a thing in the climbing community, high pointing. And, it's a great excuse to see places you might not have seen. It's also, that's what I'm doing in terms of climbing, and otherwise I'm staying really busy, with, the book promotion. The book came out May 1. It is an Amazon number one bestseller. And so it's off to a great start. Getting really great reviews. I partnered with REI, doing talks all over the place. If folks want to take one of those in, they can go to my website. I post them whenever they're booked, so you can see when I'm coming to your area.
Wonderful. And the name of the book is The Altitude Journal. And David Mauro is M-A-U-R-O. And David, your website has a J thrown in there. So it's davidjmauro.com.
davidjmauro.com. And you know, if nothing else, it's kind of a fun site to check out, because I have links to all my blogs, all my Picasa web albums. You can see hundreds of photos from these climbs, as well as some videos, including the video of that 65-year-old woman completing the seven summits from my helmet camera, which is a marvelous piece of footage to watch. So it's all on there. And if you're not sure if you want to buy the book, read a few of the blogs. They're free. If you like what you see there, you'd probably like the book. So, you know, you can check it out before committing your hard-earned dollars.
All right, on. And it sounds delightful. I'm going to pick up a copy, David. I want to read it. And the reason why is not because you're talking about climbing seven summits, though I love that. It's because the life lessons learned, you know, that you've shared with us, just a taste of that. That to me is a lot of the value of the book. So yeah, awesome. Once again, that's davidjmauro.com, and the book is The Altitude Journal. Hey, David, we are about 60 miles as the Golden Eagle flies from Mount Elbert.
Ah.
So when you decide to get the high point in Colorado, you have to swing by and come see us.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. So that's obviously on the high pointing list. And maybe you can join me on that. That'd be great. Curtis said, love to have some local expertise to keep me out of trouble.
Well, it's not that tough of a mountain, but I mean, like any 14er, you know, it has its moments, but we climbed that one in the wintertime when it was below zero, and we like to pretend that it was a big mountain.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just all about getting out there, being safe, having fun, having experiences, sharing those experiences. They don't all have to be marquee names or super high dangerous mountains. That's not required.
Nope, absolutely not. Well, David, I wish we had time to keep on going, because I have so enjoyed our discussion today. But thank you so much for sharing your time and your experiences with us.
Well, you're very welcome. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you for having me on, Curtis. To your listeners, I say thank you so much for listening. I hope it was a good experience for you, and may our paths cross again.
Well, thank you. And until the next show, you know, when I say this, everyone that's listened to the show for a while, they know it's not just about fun. When I say get out there and have some fun, it's always about growing, about life experiences, about helping others, about discovering meaning and things like that. But that's what adventure sports are for in my book. So until the next show, make sure that you do get out there and have some fun.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.